For example, the Ice Lord is in the frozen north, and Fire Sands was born in the burnt desert of Kalip. Even Bjorn Stonesledge's Ironmark is suited to your ore-sheathed forests. Nothing is as random as it seems, as if there is a hidden design to it all. There's a reason your father taught you the word Fate Mark, and I want to learn more. I suspect the Western archives will be more complete than the East's. Aye. Surely they weren't all destroyed. But I fear they are all well hidden. Nothing is hidden from the sight of a king, Roan said. Finally, Gwen smiled. You always knew who you really were, didn't you? Roan couldn't deny it any longer. I did. My guardian lied about many things, but not my lineage. Though I never used the surname, Loren, it was always there, a part of me. I knew I couldn't hide from it forever. And you would be willing to risk your life by returning to the West? I've already risked my life a dozen times in the last fortnight. What's once more? I saw you on the frozen river, the night before last, Gwen said. The abrupt change of subject made Roan flinch. You did? He frowned. He thought he'd been stealthy, but it seemed everyone knew of his midnight romp. Everyone except Gareth, perhaps. Gwen nodded. I thought for certain you were leaving. I misjudged you. Why didn't you say anything before the battle? Because we all have our demons, and we must face them alone. We should face them together, Roan said immediately. When had he started believing that? Sometime between getting infected with the plague, nearly being devoured by dragons, mauled by an orcat, and almost falling to his death in Raider's Pass. Aye, somewhere in there I have changed. You surprise me, she said. I surprise myself. But I want to know the truth about my mark. Yours, too. All of them. Good, she said. Because I'm coming with you. Roan raised one of his arms, shaking his chains. Only one problem, he said. Gwen glanced around, and Roan followed her gaze. Several torches winked orange in the darkness, but none close by. They were alone. She withdrew a key from somewhere beneath her armor. She unlocked the chains and removed his manacles, helping him to his feet. What about Gareth? Roan asked. He is king of the East now. You've done all you can for him. He is alive. He is safe. I have no choice. Silently, they moved away from camp. May we meet again, Roan thought. Despite leaving Gareth behind, for the first time in Roan's life, he felt as if he was doing the very thing he was meant to be doing at the very precise moment he was meant to be doing it.
37. The Northern Kingdom. Gearhead. Anis Gehrig. Anis sat by her brother's bedside, hunched over, exhausted but unable to sleep, while Arch's life hung in the balance. She was back in the Laughing Mammoth, then, Netta's female-only establishment that was once more making an exception for several men, including her brother. Arch's chest rose and fell, rose and fell. Several times his eyes fluttered, but did not open.
"Please," she begged the frozen gods of the north. "Don't take him too early."
His wound was grievous, and if not for Sir Dietrich, he'd surely be dead.
"I would be too," she reminded herself.
She owed the knight a life debt, one she doubted she'd ever be able to repay.
"The way he'd moved."
Supernatural was the word that sprang to mind. Her lost brother, Bane, had authority over death, and yet Sir Dietrich had defied him. None but one who was skin-marked could have defeated him, and even then it wouldn't have been easy, though it had seemed that her brother had begun to weaken toward the end of the battle, his body trembling.
"Sir Dietrich," she mused.
She remembered when her uncle had his men strip the knight naked and shine a torch over his skin. There were so many scars, interlaced like vines dangling from a woolly tree. One scar in particular had stood out on his back, a rippling burn mark larger than all the others. Would Sir Dietrich really have gone so far as to have himself severely burned in order to hide his mark? And if the answer was yes, why? He could have had a good life in the service of the crown. The finest food, the most lavish quarters. He would have stood side by side with the Ice Lord, second only to the king. But he gave up all that for a hard life as a knight in a frozen land torn apart by war. Thrice Sir Dietrich had come to check on Arch, and thrice she told him to go away. She still didn't know why, only that she wanted to be alone with her brother. Zelda had tried to talk to her too, but Anise had begged off, requesting a few days to consider what would come next. Zelda told her not to wait too long, for she had a duty to the kingdom. "I don't want this duty," Anise thought now, as she had a dozen times before. This time, however, it was harder to tell whether the words rang of truth. Anise flinched when someone cleared their throat. "Frozen hell," she muttered, seeing the giant man in the doorway. "Have you heard of knocking?"
"I didn't want to disturb your brother's sleep," Terin said, stepping inside.
Before they'd left Raider's Pass, he'd replaced his helmet. To her knowledge, he hadn't removed it since. She wondered whether he ever would again. His breastplate was dented in, the shape of a smallish fist where her brother had punched him. She still couldn't believe how much force had been behind the hit. Terin was a mountain, but he'd flown backwards like a pebble. "He's unconscious. If a battle broke out in this very room, he'd sleep right through it."
"I'm sorry," Terin said. "I wish there was something I could do, but outside of battle, I am of no use."
Images flashed through Anise's mind. Terin knocking over the famed warrior beyond the stone sledge, he who was iron-marked, swatting him aside with almost predatory ease. Terin smashing King Ironclad's head with his Morning Star. The dark look in Terin's eyes when he was strangling the farmer, Killorn, what seemed like an eternity ago. Yes, Terin had mastered the art of violence long ago, either due to circumstance, experience, or simply because of the black blood flowing through his veins. Anise blinked and forced herself to replace the disturbing images with others, Terin wrapping his arm around her, his warmth flowing through her. The twinkle in his eyes when he first looked at her with undisguised awe and called her the Bear Slayer. The way he always defended her against her own self-deprecating quips, like she was worth more than the sum of her external parts. "You are a good man," Anise said finally, realizing the knight had been staring at her for a long time, his head cocked to the side. Terin's eyes narrowed behind his faceplate.
"Your mother said that to me once."
The mention of her mother made Anise choke slightly. Perhaps it was because Arch was now fighting for his life that she felt suddenly emotional. "She was right," she said, "no matter what the rest of the kingdom says." Terin shook his head, but he wasn't disagreeing.
"Sounds like good advice. Maybe you should listen to it yourself."
Anise smirked at the knight's cleverness. He'd caught her in her own words. A swell of something magnanimous and heavy filled her belly, her chest, her throat. Her mouth watered with feeling for this knight who hid behind plate and metal and dark mesh. "Take off your mask," she said. Terin didn't move, frozen in place. "I am the queen," she said, feeling slightly bad for using her position so frivolously. "I command it."
"You have seen my face once, and you would dare to look upon it again?"
Terin asked. She could see the confusion in his shadowy eyes. "You question the courage of the woman who played snow wars with an ice bear and emerged victorious," Anise said, trying to keep the mood light. Terin chuckled, but still didn't move to take off his helmet.
"I'm willing to barter. I will show you my face if you will look in that mirror."
He pointed to a looking glass hanging over a dressing table. Anise had been avoiding it ever since Arch was given this room for his recovery. "Why?" Anise asked.
because I want you to see what I see.
I? What's that? A pair with arms?
No, Terrin said, his eyes serious. Someone beautiful and strong and determined.
She wanted to laugh at the fact that he'd not only used the word beautiful to describe her, but that he'd said it first in his list of compliments. But she couldn't, because there was no jest in his voice.
Frozen hell, man, she thought. We must both be blind or stupid. Or both.
But still, she wanted him to remove his mask, and she could take a quick peek at her arch-enemy, the mirror.
Fine. I'll look.
Like it was nothing, she stood and stomped over to the looking-glass, standing directly in front of it. She froze. It was her, all right. Muscled arms, broad shoulders, wide, dimpled chin. But there was something different there, too. Something she'd never seen before. Steel in her eyes. Determination in the set of her jaw. It was the face of a queen. She turned away, as if she saw nothing but Princess Anise from Castle Hill.
There. Satisfied? Your turn, she said.
Terrin nodded.
You're a terrible actress, he said.
And then he removed his helmet and placed it on the dressing table. Anise tried not to stare, but it was impossible. She could see his veins through his skin, bulging from his flesh, black blood streaming through them. She could see the ivory of the bones in his jaw, thick and strong. There were so many things about his appearance that should scare a normal person, give them nightmares, make them run away screaming. But Anise was no normal person, and the thing she noticed above all else were his eyes. His eyes were the same, conveying the entirety of his facial expression in a single glance. She could see the self-hatred, the fear, and something else that couldn't be hidden behind his own self-loathing. The thing he felt for her. She could see the love. And beneath whatever the witch had done to him while sparing his life, he was a handsome man, every bit as attractive as Sir Dietrich with his rugged manliness and scars. She lunged at Terrin, and he caught her in his strong arms. Her lips found his, and for a moment the kiss was one-sided, making her wonder if she'd misinterpreted everything. But then, slowly, firmly, his lips moved against hers. She cupped her hands around his cheeks, letting her fingers roam his skin, which was unnaturally smooth, save for the ridges caused by the protruding veins. None of that mattered now. All that mattered was that they were here together. When Terrin had gone, the massive hunk of man fumbling to replace his helmet like a young boy, Anise smiled at herself in the mirror. Her reflection returned her smile, and there was something about the way it lit up her face that wasn't so bad. Arch would recover, she knew, as she turned to watch him sleep. But he wouldn't be king.
No, not until Queen Anise, the Bear Slayer, is dead.
She left the room, finally ready to speak to her aunt about the future of the kingdom. 38. The Western Kingdom, the Crimean Sea, off the coast of Talis. Grey Aris. The sea-worn ship bucked and writhed beneath his feet, causing Grey's stomach to lurch once more. He hung over the wobbly railing, spewing out the little that was left in his empty stomach. It was only the first day of a voyage that would take several weeks, and yet he already felt like death. His stump was clearly infected, and his stomach hated the sea.
"You all right, lad?"
one of the crew members asked, clapping a hand on his back. Grey spit into the blue waters of the ocean and nodded thinly.
"Captain Smithers said you can take the day off till you find your sea legs."
Grey let out a heavy sigh of relief. Hopefully a good rest while his body grew accustomed to the rise and swell of the sea would do the trick.
"Thank you," he said. "But what if I don't find my sea legs? Then we'll throw you to the sea monsters,"
the man said, laughing. As Grey stumbled below decks, he wished he hadn't asked. Being below decks did little for his nausea, which rose and fell in pattern with the sea. He tried to sleep on the salt-stained sheets in his bunk, but he couldn't stop thinking about two people. Rhea and Shay. Not necessarily in that order. Even as the ship sailed away from the west, Grey had the urge to ask the captain to turn it around. He could go back to Night's End, plead with her to help him find his sister. After all, the Furia were hers to command now. She could force them to bring Shay back. Rhea owed him that much, especially now that her father was dead and she was queen. More than that, he desperately wanted to see her again, to somehow reconcile the mistakes they'd both made, pour water on the angry flames that had seemed to erupt out of nowhere between them. An impossible idea. Regardless of what had transpired between them, she was a queen and he was a thief? A pathetic, lost boy without a hand? A jape with no punchline? Tears pricked his dry eyes, stinging. A tear fell, then another. So foreign to his face, there might have been strange blue rain in cloudless skies. For the first time in 9 years, for the first time since his parents' deaths, he wept. And when he was finished, he wiped the tears and snot from his face, gritted his teeth, and clenched his fists. It was the same reaction he'd had the last time he'd cried. Refusal to go quietly into the night. Refusal to give up on his sister or himself. No, he thought fiercely, biting back another swell of nausea. I'm a brother. I'm Shay's brother, and I won't abandon her to the Furia. As those determined thoughts rattled around in his brain, he swore he could see the infection in his stump grow, poisoning his blood, sucking the life from his soul. He only hoped he would live long enough to find Shay. 39. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Lorraine. The Fury was bound by her own archaic laws, a fact that Rhea couldn't help but to relish. Her sins had been forgiven by the king just before he died. Therefore, in the eyes of Roth, she was once more eligible to inherit the throne. An absurd rule. Why should a king have the power to forgive sins? But one that was benefiting her now. As the Fury dripped holy water on Rhea's head, the crimson-haired warrior said, "By Roth's authority, I anoint you Queen Rhea Lorraine, ruler of the West and holy symbol for the realm." As the golden crown was placed atop her head, the water snaked its way into Rhea's scars, funneling down toward her chin, where it cascaded to her feet. She didn't need to hide her face. Never would she hide it again. If she couldn't be Rhea the Beautiful, she would be Rhea the Beloved, Rhea the Holy, Rhea the Fierce. Either that or Rhea the Feared. She hadn't decided yet. Rhea smiled, as the masses who'd gathered to witness her coronation cheered. For her. "Today is a day of forgiveness," she announced. "Today, all sins shall be forgiven." As the crowd pushed forward, she bent down and extended her arm. They pressed their lips against the same blue diamond ring she'd kissed to earn her own forgiveness. They looked at the scar on her face, not with judgment or disgust, but with adoration. After the rest of the Lorraines learned that Jove had been murdered right in front of Rhea's eyes, a story had been hastily concocted to explain the W on her face. The lie was necessary if the people were to respect her. It was said that she loved Roth so much, was so dedicated to his righteous cause, that she'd used a holy knife to etch his symbol into her own skin. "What righteousness," the people were heard to have said. "Her holiness rises above us all." Already, the most devout servants of Roth were following her lead, carving his symbol onto their own faces. She could see several such worshippers in the crowd, their cheeks rent with ragged, blood-clotted lines. Rhea rose from her crouch, stepping purposely in front of the Fury, blocking the holy warrior as she faced the people. Her people. She smiled. She waved. She soaked in their admiration. A few days earlier, she'd pretended to be in shock as the guards had carried her away from Jove's corpse. She'd refused to eat or speak or leave her room. When her cousins had finally managed to drag the story from her lips, how a demon had appeared in the throne room a moment after she'd kissed King Jove's holy ring. How the evil creature had killed the king in cold blood, slashed Rhea's stomach and then vanished. How she'd tried to put pressure on her cousin's wound, his blood coating her dress. They'd believed her. Only Ennis seemed unsure, his gaze suspicious, especially when he learned the killing stroke had been dealt using a blade of shattered glass. But he wisely had voiced no concern regarding the truth of her tale. Even her twin siblings had hugged her, sobbed into her chest, begging her forgiveness for the way they'd treated her. She knew they weren't being sincere, only playing to the future queen. She'd sobbed along with them, speaking the words they expected, resisting the urge to wring their little necks. The healers said she'd been lucky the wound to her stomach was only skin deep. It would heal. Some herbal ointment and a few bandages would do the trick. It might not even scar. Not that it mattered. Scars meant little to Rhea now. Not one of her cousins challenged her new claim to the throne. After 2 dead kings in as many days, she could see the fear in their eyes. Rumours of monsters and demons were being repeated over and over again throughout the city, not only in temples, but in shops, cafes, and homes. The people were scared, and she would take full advantage. The people cheered and cheered and cheered some more, showering the dais with handfuls of fragrant rose petals. She picked one up and breathed it in. It was the smell of defiance, of victory. Whatever evil had killed her father, it had not killed her. Her cousin had thrust her aside like a petulant child, using his righteous dog, the Fury, to scar her, to maim her. But he had not had the stomach or foresight to finish her off. That had proved to be a fatal mistake. Then she'd been a weak, naive little girl. Now she was strong and spiteful and angry at the world that had failed her. She would not fail herself. She would not fail the West. Later on, when she was back inside the castle and the self-declared day of forgiveness was coming to a close, Rhea sat in front of her mirror, which had been replaced upon her request, brushing the knots out of her hair. Although her reflection in the looking-glass continued to shock her, she forced herself to stare at what she'd become. A monster, she thought. For once, the thought did not bring her sadness. No, not any more. Now it brought her anger. But not only anger, satisfaction, too. For this monster had become a queen. She pulled her brush through her lustrous golden hair, humming softly to herself. Yes, today she had been the righteous, holy queen that Night's End deserved, giving the realm hope for a better future. With a sudden jerk of her hand, she slammed the hairbrush down on the dressing table, shattering its wooden handle, sending it spinning across the shiny floor. She hissed at her horrifying reflection, her heart racing at how unhinged she looked. Staring at herself, she resisted the urge to shatter the mirror once more, this time with her fist. She longed to feel physical pain, a distraction from her inner turmoil. "Tomorrow, the 4 kingdoms will burn," she growled. And then she gave in to the temptation, thrusting her fist forward, smashing the glass, relishing the tinkle of the broken shards as they rained down upon her dressing table. The tight flesh of her knuckles was broken, smeared with warm blood. She raised her hand to her lips and licked the blood off. "Yes," she thought, "I am unhinged, and I like it." She spun around to face the Fury who had carved her face like a butcher. The strong woman was bound to a chair, a dirty rag stuffed into her mouth. She'd had several of her most trusted guards abduct the red-cloaked warrior shortly after the coronation. The Fury tried to scream at her through the gag, but it came out as nothing more than a muffled growl. Her face turned as red as her cloak as she struggled against the ropes, which chafed against her muscular body. Rhea smiled wickedly, idly resting her hand on a silver platter that contained several freshly sharpened knives, gleaming under the light of the wall sconces.
"Is something the matter?"
Rhea asked, cocking her head to the side.
"Surely a fury would want to follow the holy lead of the queen. Am I mistaken?"
The fury stopped moving, her cheeks paling.
"No,"
Rhea said.
"No matter. You will thank me later."
She kicked out, her bare foot catching the fury in the chest. The chair rocked backwards, landing with a rough thud on the hard floor. After selecting the longest, sharpest knife from the tray, Rhea sauntered over, taking her time, relishing the moment. After a brief hesitation, she knelt down and tightened her grip on the blade's handle. And then she began to carve, ripping the rag from the fury's mouth so she could hear her screams. This is the end of Book One, but the story continues with 6 postlude stories in the Fate-Marked Epic series. Keep listening after the credits to hear more. You have been listening to Fate-Marked, Book One of the Fate-Marked Epic. Produced by Greg Lawrence. Associate producer Emily Durr. Text copyright 2017 by David Estes. Production copyright 2017 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. Postludes. Postlude 1. Terran Shiri, the Northern Kingdom, circa 522. 8-year-old Terran Shiri knew he was dying. It started with his legs. One day he was simply unable to stand. His legs felt weak, like he'd been punched 12 times in each muscle. They looked different, too. Though he'd always been skinny and bony, they looked too skinny now, resembling the legs of a chicken. When he collapsed getting out of bed, his mother scooped him up and carried him to the castle healer. After inspecting Terran using an oddly shaped circle of glass, the round-faced man broke the news with little compassion.
"The disease has already entered his bones. He will not last a fortnight."
Terran's mother wept, which scared him quite a lot. He'd never seen her cry, not even when she was kicked in the chest by a stubborn mule and could scarcely breathe. Not even when his baby brother or sister passed on while still in her swollen belly. She was a northern woman through and through, as hard as iron. But now she wept. Terran's father comforted her, pushing back her hair which was streaked with grey, like wispers of wind. He dried her cheeks with the corner of a blanket, which he wrapped around her shoulders. And then he approached his son, who was propped up in bed. Terran didn't look at his father. He couldn't look at him, not when he was so weak. He didn't want to disappoint the man he'd always looked up to. His father had come from humble beginnings, the son of a pig farmer. He'd worked hard his entire life, apprenticing himself to a horse master, and eventually becoming one himself, the finest in the realm. Now he worked in the royal stables, breeding and training horses for King Garrick himself.
"Son," his father said now.
Still Terran didn't look, his eyes trained firmly on his shrunken legs. He wondered whether he'd be remembered as Terran the Maimed, the same way the king's lost eldest brother was known as Helmuth the Maimed. On the edge of his vision, he could see his father's thick moustache, speckled with what his mother called "just the right amount of snow and ash." His father sighed.
"This is a hard world, son. But only the strongest are chosen to face the hardest things. Someone is telling you that you are strong. That is all."
Terran swallowed. He reached down and touched his legs. He didn't feel strong. He felt numb, almost like he was looking at someone else's legs, which couldn't possibly be attached to his body. He didn't want to prove his father wrong and cry. But the tears were like a flood bursting from a shattered dam, swamping his vision, streaking down his cheeks in hot streams.
"I don't want to die,"
he cried, and his father held him close. Though his mother tried to muffle her own sobs, he could hear them from across the room. Terran's best friend in all the 4 kingdoms, Princess Anise Garrick, came by to see him the next day. She sat on the edge of his bed and stared at his legs.
"I don't understand," she said. "They said you were sick, But you don't look sick. Are your legs broken?
He shook his head, but it wasn't an answer.
No, just weak. Everything is weak.
His father's words echoed in his head.
Someone is telling you that you are strong.
He wanted to punch the words, break them apart. He knew his letters, so he figured he could write the word strong on a sheet of parchment and then rip it to shreds. Then he could burn each piece in the fire. Maybe that would make him feel better.
Frozen hell,
Anise swore, which almost made Taryn laugh. Anise was so different than all the other girls in the castle. She wrestled with the boys, and usually won, cursed like the soldiers, and didn't seem to mind that her dresses were dirty most of the time.
When will you be able to play again? It's summer.
The thought of missing out on summer hurt Taryn so much he could feel an ache in his chest. He didn't want to say the words, not because of his feelings, but because of hers. He didn't want to see her sad.
I don't know, he finished lamely. Well, I won't go outside to play until you can come with me,
Anise said. The earnestness of her promise was evident in the way she jutted out her broad Garrick jaw. Her brown eyes were coals of smouldering determination. Taryn knew all too well that once the young princess said something, she would do it. But that's not what he wanted.
No,
he said, a lie coating his tongue. He'd never lied to his friend before, but he had to now.
I'll be fine. I just need to rest for 2 or 3 days. Don't wait for me. I'll see you when I'm well again.
Anise squinted.
Is this a trick? Because if this is a trick...
She held up a fist. Taryn finally laughed for real, and Anise joined him. When she left, Taryn lifted his legs over the side of the bed. He was shocked at how light they were, like his bones and muscles and skin were turning into air. He set his bare feet on the stone floor, which was cool under his heels. Then, gritting his teeth until his jaw ached, Taryn pushed off from the bed with his hands and stood. He wobbled for a few moments, trying to maintain his balance, took a deep breath, steadied himself, gathered all his strength.
Strong, strong, strong,
the word echoed, not broken, not burned, still a part of him, and stepped forward. His legs crumpled like a wooden soldier under the force of a hammer blow. His knees cracked against the stone, sending shards of pain through his bones. His hands slammed down next, and then his jaw, which made an awful cracking sound. He lay there for a long time, groaning, unable to move. That's how his mother found him when she returned from her duties tending to the mules. Taryn was used to seeing the Queen in their humble dwellings. After all, Queen Sabria Lorraine Garrick had been friends with his mother for as long as he could remember, visiting her once a fortnight, always during the dim twilight of evening, arriving cloaked and quiet at their back door. Taryn had never told Anise, because the Queen had asked him not to.
"Your mother and I are secret friends, and no one can know. Not even my daughter. Especially not my daughter."
Taryn suspected it was because his mother was also from the West, though her features were not as fair or as soft as the Queen's. He knew that was why they were friends. The Queen had said it herself.
"You are my taste of home,"
she often said of Taryn's mother. When Anise had confided in Taryn that she didn't think her mother loved her, it had taken all of Taryn's inner strength to bite his tongue and say nothing regarding what he knew about the Queen. Usually Taryn's mother and the Queen talked about light things, like their children, the castle gossip, the weather, and whether they'd heard any news from the West. But not tonight. Tonight, Taryn knew they were talking about the disease eating him from the inside. He knew because his mother wouldn't look at him, and they spoke in hushed voices so he couldn't hear. Every once in a while, however, he caught a word or two.
"Days left. So scared. Second healer. Rumours. A woman. Dark magic."
Taryn's ear perked up.
Magic? He'd never heard his mother or the Queen speak of magic, except for the rare slip of his mother's tongue when she'd condemned the brutal actions of the Ice Lord, a skin-marked man who worked for the King and was capable of freezing the hair off a goat's chin. Why would they mention magic now? What did that have to do with his legs? Was his condition caused by something more sinister, like a dark sorcerer who was casting spells across the land? Terrin's mind raced with the possibilities. Now his mother and the Queen seemed to be arguing, which Terrin had never seen them do. The argument swiftly changed, however, when all the fight went out of Terrin's mother, and she collapsed into the Queen's arms. The Queen held her for a long time by the fire. She glanced at Terrin, and though he felt as if he should look away, he couldn't. Her crystal blue gaze locked on his. She smiled at him, and he managed a thin smile back. Her hair fell to her shoulders like a beautiful waterfall, made golden by the sun's reflection. And then she kissed both of his mother's cheeks and swept from the room, pulling her cloak over her head, before slipping through the back door and into the night. According to Terrin's mother, the new healer had been arranged by the Queen. But Terrin knew there was more to it than that. He'd seen their argument, seen his mother's fear, heard that whispered word, magic. Whatever they were planning, he knew it involved more than a standard healer's ointments, herbs, and tonics. Yet Terrin couldn't help his excitement, and he clung to the idea like a starving dog to a bone. Magic can save me, he thought, as he waited for the healer to arrive. And when I'm well, I can surprise Anise. His father wasn't home yet, and his mother had just started boiling a pot of hot water. Terrin's jaw was still sore from his fall, and his hands were scraped raw. His knees were bruised and swollen, but they didn't hurt too much. Every time he heard footsteps outside their house, he tensed in anticipation. And when there was finally a knock on the door, his heart practically jumped out of his chest. Mother! He called. But she was already racing for the door, yanking it open so hard it slammed against the wall. Someone entered, their face shrouded by a dark hood. Terrin's mother said, Thank you for coming. I've boiled water, just as you instructed.
Leave,
a strange voice said. It was harsh, almost mannish, but clearly that of a woman. She sounded old, like her voice hadn't been used recently.
What? No. I need to be here for my son.
The woman threw back her hood, and Terrin gasped. She was completely bald, not even a wisp of hair on her scalp. And her skin was as dark as night. He'd heard tales about some places in the Southern Kingdom, Caleb for one, where the people had skin like obsidian. But he'd never met someone from there before.
The best way for you to help your son is to leave,
the hairless woman said. Terrin's mother didn't move, frozen in a moment of indecision. But then Terrin said,
Mother, I'm fine.
He knew they both had to be strong. She moved over to him and took his hand.
No matter what happens, she said, I love you. I'll return soon.
Not too soon,
the woman said. Terrin nodded and watched his mother leave. Then he was alone with the woman, who unslung a leather pouch from her shoulder and began to pluck contents out, placing them on the wooden table next to his bed. Terrin watched her, dimly aware that he was being rude by staring, but she didn't seem to notice or mind. Her skin was as smooth as glass, her eyes as dark as her skin. The contrast to her teeth was stark, and they seemed to glow bright white between her lips, which were dark pink. The items she set on the small table were strange, some kind of a bone bleached white by the sun, what appeared to be a tooth from some beast, sharp and pointed, a vial of a dark liquid that might have been blood, stoppered with a small bit of cork, 12 tiny blue eggs, an iron capsule, and finally several pink flower petals, which she crushed between her fingers. Terrin murmured under his breath.
Hope flowers, he said.
The woman smiled, displaying her white teeth.
True, but hope is a funny thing. It comes to us in ways we cannot predict.
Terran wasn't sure what she meant exactly, but it made him feel cold inside. Based on the items she'd laid out, what he'd overheard his mother and the Queen talking about, and the way she looked, he knew she wasn't a normal healer.
"You're a witch," he said.
She turned her back on him, but didn't respond.
"Frozen hell," he thought. "The Queen has sent us a witch."
And yet, as much as it should scare him, it didn't. He was already looking death in the eye. Everything else seemed small in comparison. The woman witch removed the boiling water from where it hung over the fire. She went about her business, dropping each ingredient into the bubbles. She uncorked the vial and poured the liquid in, drop by drop. The eggs she cracked individually, removing only the yolks and dropping the broken shells on the floor. His mother was going to have a mess to clean up when she returned. Lastly, she sprinkled the crushed hope flowers into the mixture. Terran watched as they floated on top for a few seconds, before slowly sinking into the amber liquid. When she was finished, she said, "Drink," and used a ladle to gather a portion of the concoction.
"It's still hot,"
Terran said, shrinking back. Steam was wafting from the pot, warming the air. The liquid would scald his tongue and throat. At least that's what he told himself. In truth, he was scared to drink it for other reasons.
"Drink or die,"
the witch said. He didn't want to die. Terran steeled himself, trying to remember what his father had said about strength. Took a deep breath and drank. He gagged, the burning, foul potion threatening to spill back out, but the witch sealed his lips with one hand while pinching his nose with the other. Bit by bit, he choked it down. She gave him more, and with each spoonful it became easier to swallow. As he drank, she spoke in a whispery voice.
"What is weak is made strong. What is broken is made whole. What is lost is found. Turn his bones to iron, and his muscles to stone, and his flesh to glass, and his blood to ash."
By the time Terran had consumed the last drop, he was feeling full and warm. And tingly, like he'd just come out of the wintry cold and was slowly being warmed by the fire. The witch hooked her pouch around her neck, pulled her dark hood over her face, and left as quickly as she'd come, without a word. Terran blinked, surprised.
"What happened? Is she embarrassed that her spell didn't work? That she'd failed?"
He didn't feel any different. His legs were still weak and shriveled, his hands still trembling from fatigue. The only difference was that his belly was full of a vile concoction that would likely make him ill. He bit his lip, sorrow pressing in once more. No one could save him now. Not even the dark magic of a witch. He slumped back into his pillow and closed his eyes. The pain came so fast and so strong that his eyes flashed open and he shrieked. His head cracked against the wall and his arms flailed, his entire body convulsing from the agony rippling through him like a dark tide. He felt like vomiting, his stomach heaving, his mouth gaping open again and again, but nothing came up, just dry air and bitter drool. Somewhere in the back of his mind, he was aware of what was happening. His mother bursting through the door, then his father, strong arms holding him down, protecting him from himself, soothing voices comforting him, and then darkness, blessed darkness, and nothing. When Terran awoke, he felt different. He wasn't sure exactly how, not even when he opened his eyes, blinked, and looked down at his legs, which were covered by a woolen blanket. He was warm, hot even, but he wasn't sweating. His arms were tucked under the blanket, too, and when he tried to move, he found himself quite stuck.
"Oh, no," he thought. "I'm worse. Much worse."
And yet something wasn't quite right. Though he still couldn't move his arms or legs, he didn't feel weak any more. He tried to sit up, but found himself pinned by something, a restraint of some kind. That's when he realized he was tied to the bed.
Mother!
He called. Yet it wasn't his voice he heard, but the voice of a stranger. It was deeper, gruffer, like the voices of the soldiers who roamed the castle.
What's happening to me?
And then his mother was there, by his side, her face awash with concern, but something else, too. Relief, maybe? Yes, relief, but also fear. The moment he saw the fear in her eyes, Taryn felt sick to his stomach. Why would she be scared if he was truly cured?
"I'm still dying," he said.
"No," his mother said quickly. "You're not." He realized she hadn't touched him, hadn't kissed him. His mother had always been an affectionate person, but now he sensed a barrier between them, a thickness in the air she was unwilling to penetrate.
"Then why are you scared for me?"
"Wait." He'd misjudged her fear. She wasn't scared for him. She was scared of him.
"Mother?"
That gruff voice.
"No, it's my voice now," he realized.
"Oh, heart," she said, her hand hovering in the air between them, blocked by that hell-frozen barrier.
"I didn't know what else to do. I just wanted my baby to live. I'm sorry."
She backed away, repeating that word, sorry, again and again, only silenced when the door closed behind her. Taryn was alone, and yet he heard a voice.
"I'm here. You're not alone." "Who's there?"
he asked, alarmed.
"Father?" "I could be your father. I already have a father." "Not anymore." "Liar!"
Taryn said, straining against the ropes, anger heating his blood, sending strength to his limbs. He wanted to see whoever was talking to him, wanted to hurt them, to make them shut their lying mouth. He'd never felt such pure rage before, like an inferno raging through his entire body. He hated feeling this way. He loved it, too, like he was truly alive for the first time in his life. And he felt powerful, even as the ropes snapped, breaking away from his arms and legs, even as he threw off the blanket and leapt to his feet, his legs strong and sturdy, stronger and sturdier than before, scanning the room for the bearer of that cursed, lying voice, and the room was empty. He stood there, panting, his fingers curling and uncurling at his sides, pent-up energy seeming to drip from his hands.
"Show yourself!" he said.
He grabbed the small wooden table by his bed and smashed it against the wall. Wooden splinters went every which way as the legs snapped off.
"I'm in the looking glass,"
the voice said, so close that Taryn whirled around, swinging a closed fist wildly. He caught only air. Confusion settled in. That's when he noticed his arm, which was bare. His skin was like frosted glass, not pale exactly, but transparent. Through his flesh he could see his veins, which had turned black and been lifted up, protruding from his skin like tiny snakes. But that wasn't all. When he opened and closed his fist, he saw muscles rippling beneath the surface of his skin, practically bulging. Everything was thicker, too, like his very bones had expanded. The witch's spell came back to him.
"Made strong, made whole. Bones to iron, muscles to stone, flesh to glass, blood to ash."
A tremor shuddered through him.
"I'm in the looking glass,"
the voice repeated. And this time Taryn sought out the only mirror they had, a tiny oval framed by rusty tin. He snatched it from where it lay, spun it around, and stared into it, seeking out the owner of the voice. What he saw horrified him. After throwing on a thick winter coat, though it was summer, he wanted to cover himself. Taryn left home through the back door, scuttling between buildings, sticking to the shadows. Somewhere along the way he began to cry, but when he brushed away the tears, his fingers came back black. With a muffled sob, he wiped his fingers clean on his cloak, but they still looked grey. He didn't want anyone he knew to see him like this, so he hurried on, even when someone shouted in his general direction. He was aware that his shadow was taller and thicker, because he was taller and thicker. The thought only made him run faster. He should have been breathing heavily by now, but instead his lungs were strong and consistent, like he was standing still and not sprinting along the muddy hills of Castle Hill. He didn't stop until he'd reached the edge of the city, looking back at the tangled web of houses and farms surrounding the castle, which stood gleaming white in the sunlight on the highest hill. Could he really leave his mother, who he loved, who had done so much for him?
"You have no mother."
And his father, who had given him a good life despite his humble beginnings?
"You have no father."
And his best friend Anise, who was surely waiting for him to come outside and play knights and trolls with her.
"You have no friends. You have no one but me."
He knew it was true, because he was Taryn no longer, not even a shadow of his former self.
"Who are you?"
he asked the thing inside of him.
"I am you, and you are me. We are strongest when we are one."
Taryn didn't like the sound of the voice, but he knew he had no other choice. After all, the voice had saved him and cursed him all at the same time, just as the witch had saved him and cursed him. With one final look, he turned away from Castle Hill, away from his home, away from everyone he'd ever loved. No one knew how young Taryn was. 2 full moons after the witch had forced her hot potion down his throat, he was already as tall and broad as a man grown. Not knowing which way to go, he'd set out east, and was now somewhere between Castle Hill and the lesser castle of Walburg. All he knew was that he needed to get as far away from his family as possible before he changed his mind. Occasionally he came across small farming villages. He never let anyone see him, covering his hands, body and face with thick folds of cloth. He survived on scraps of food flung his way when scared farmers saw him coming. Everyone who saw his strange attire assumed he bore some disease.
"Not any more,"
he thought, chewing on a half-frozen heel of bread. It used to hurt, seeing the terror in the eyes of the people he came across. He'd cried the first time someone had run from him. But not any more. His black tears scared him too much, for one. And it was better that those he encountered feared him, stayed away from him.
"Yes,"
the voice agreed.
"You only need me."
He relished the dark of night, when none but the northern beasts would be able to see him through the inky gloom. It was only then that he pulled back the scarf covering his face and breathed in the night air, which had grown quite cold, autumn chasing away summer with an icy sword. Yet the cold didn't seem to penetrate his skin any more. He slept under the stars, staring up at the fathomless sky, sometimes gazing at the twinkle of a single yellow-white star for hours at a time, wondering whether they felt as alone as he did, wondering whether Anise was looking at the same stars as him, wondering whether she missed playing with him, or had already found another friend. The only time he found true peace was when he slept.
"I can show you peace,"
the voice would whisper, just before he drifted away into oblivion. Every few days he was forced to curl up into a ball as his body was racked with violent tremors, accompanied by vines of agony that seemed to split his bones apart before mending them back together. As much as he hated the pain, he loved it, too, because it reminded him that he was still human, or something like it, that he was alive, or something like it, that he could still feel something. Also, the agony chased away the sadness that threatened to suffocate him. And when blessed sleep would finally come, he never dreamed, remembering only a deep, impenetrable blackness that felt more like home than anywhere else. He hated waking up from those sleeps, hated coming back to the reality that was his new existence, hated the way he was always changed, standing taller, his footsteps sinking further into the mud and snow. He'd thought he was a monster before, which made him wonder exactly what he was now. All he could do was put one foot in front of the other and continue walking toward something he couldn't quite explain. A destiny? A future? Whatever it was, it felt better than standing still. After months of travelling, Terin finally reached Wahlberg, a grey stone castle with high turrets and four small towers surrounding a larger one. He'd never seen a castle besides Castle Hill, and he was amazed at how different this structure was from the white stone blocks of the king's fortress.
"Can I make this place my home?" he wondered.
Immediately, he noticed a difference as he passed along the cobblestone streets. Though people raised their eyebrows and passed as far away from him as possible, they didn't run from him. The reason soon presented itself as he came across alleyways between the stone buildings. The narrow corridors were strewn with humans sleeping in various positions, covered head to foot with cloth to keep warm. He knew there were beggars and vagrants, but then again so was he. The thought actually made him smile beneath his scarf. In this city, he wouldn't stick out as much as he'd expected. He could blend in, and none would notice him. Except for one problem. He'd grown even more, something he realized when he passed a marketplace. One of the vendors was selling jewelry and other trinkets, including mirrors. One mirror stood tall and narrow, and when Terin reached it, he sucked in a quick breath. The person he saw wasn't a man, but a giant, too large to be captured on the mirror's face. Everyone in the marketplace was looking up at him, most of them staring.
"I'm just a boy," he wanted to shout. "I just had my 9th name day."
But he knew no one would believe him, nor would such information help him. It would only make them even more scared of him. That's when he saw it. A large tent sat atop a broad wooden pavilion. A sign hung, an announcement in large letters. "Wahlberg Annual Tournament of Champions. Preliminary rounds open to all. Enter here."
"Yes," the voice inside him said.
Terin headed for the tent.
"Name,"
the man said, his quill ready to scrawl Terin's information on a scroll, its corners weighed down against the wind by small rocks. He hadn't looked at Terin, one hand idly stroking a wispy brown beard. Terin considered the question.
"Choose,"
the voice said, and he knew what it meant. He could remain the 8-year-old boy who had been bedridden and dying in Castle Hill, or become the man who'd traversed the harsh lands to Wahlberg.
"Choose,"
he said aloud, still considering. The man, however, took it for an answer.
"Choose,"
he wrote on his page, only then looking up to see who had spoken. His eyes widened and he snorted.
"You're a big fellow with a strange name,"
he said.
"Shall I add a title?"
Terin had watched enough tournaments with Anise in Castle Hill to know what he was truly asking. There were the knights and everyone else. Because of his sheer size, the man was open to the idea that Terin might bear the title Sir. Terin almost laughed. "Me, a knight?" But instead only shook his head. After scratching an X next to the name, the man said,
"Events?"
Terin hadn't thought about it yet. Though the premier event at any tourney was the joust, he had no idea whether he could still ride. As a boy, his father had taught him to be an excellent horseman, but now he weighed at least 2 stones more. Additionally, he'd never held a lance in his life, nor did he have a horse. No, the joust was out. Archery had never been his strong suit either. There were several other events of skill and talent, too, but he ignored those as well. That left the duel and the melee.
"How many can I choose?"
he asked.
"You can choose 2, choose,"
the man said, chuckling at his own jest.
"But you only need choose 1 if you prefer."
The voice pounded in his head, and he listened.
"The melee,"
he said.
"Just the melee. Weapon of choice?"
Terin's shoulders slumped. He had no weapon but the cursed strength in his bones. A man stepped forward and said,
"I will sponsor this entrant."
Through the slit in his scarf, Terin gaped at the man. He was old, but not withered, with broad shoulders and thick forearms corded with muscle. His face was pocked with scars, and his nose bent slightly too far to the left.